Call this meeting the State Lands Commission to order. All the representatives of the commission are present. I'm Chris Garland, Lieutenant Governor's Chief of Staff and Designee to the Commission. I'm joined today by the State Controller's Designee, Mr. Alan Gordon, and Pedro Reyes, representing the Director of Finance. For those of you in the audience, the State Lands Commission manages state properties interests in over 5 million acres of land, including mineral interests. Specifically, the Commission has jurisdiction in filled and unfilled tide and submerged lands, navigable waterways, and state school lands. The Commission also has responsibility for the prevention of oil spills at marine terminals and offshore oil platforms, and for prevention of the introduction of marine invasive species into California's marine waters. Today we'll hear requests and presentations concerning the leasing, management, and regulation of these public sovereign and school land property interests and the activities occurring or proposed thereon. The first item of business would be the adoption of the minutes from the Commission's January 24th, 2013 special meeting. Do I have a motion?
Move adoption of the minutes.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
The for those in the audience, because there is no principle here, let me turn it over to Jennifer to explain our voting system.
So pursuant to the government code section 7.6, I believe, the because neither constitutional officer is here at the meeting, only one of those offices can vote. The other has to abstain. So for the minutes, who voted?
Alan and Pedro.
Excellent.
So they're adopted. The next order of business is the executive officer's report. Ms. Lucchese, may we have that report?
Good morning. I just have a couple of things to report. At the direction of the Lieutenant Governor, and also in response to recommendations in the by the Bureau of State Audit on the report in 2011 on the Commission's leasing practices, staff is currently exploring a new lease database project. A team of management staff has been established to identify agency needs and improvements to the lease and accounting databases. Staff has met with vendors and discussed needs and capabilities, and we are currently completing the required business case justification and drafting a scope of work. We anticipate procurement documents will be circulated to vendors in March. Staff has also initiated the rulemaking process through OAL to update certain sections of its land management regulations. This is also in response to the Bureau of State Audit's report. Specifically, the sections to be updated pertain to the definition of sovereign lands and other terms, the leasing of state lands, and rental rates for leasing. Staff has sent a notification of the proposed updates to a global list of all of our lessees, the distribution list of people that have requested our meeting agendas, and some other people that may be interested but didn't show up on either list. In addition, staff will hold a public hearing beginning at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, April 16, 2013, in the Sacramento offices of the Commission. Finally, as you may know, the Commission was established on June 11, 1938, and we'll be celebrating our 75th anniversary this year. Staff has asked Assemblymember Bonnie Lowenthal to sponsor a 75th anniversary display in the four glass cases on the second floor rotunda of the State Capitol, which would feature the history and accomplishments of the Commission. We are awaiting a response from the Joint Rules Committee, who must approve the use of the exhibit cases. And on Wednesday, the Commission was honored by the California Maritime Leadership Symposium by receiving the Honoree of Merit Award. The Honoree of Merit Award is bestowed each year upon an individual organization that has made significant contributions to the marine transportation system in the state of California. As the 2013 honoree, the Commission was recognized for its 75th anniversary and acknowledged for its stewardship to the lands, waterways, and resources entrusted to its care through economic development, preservation, and restoration. And that concludes my report.
Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Lucchese. I want to, on behalf of the Lieutenant Governor, say thank you for all the work you're doing on the lease database, and thank you for the report on that. Any comments by other commissioners on that?
Mr. Chair, I was at the ceremonies at the event, and I was surprised, and I want to make sure folks know that one of our own back there actually was named as an award is named after him. And it was the third year that was given out, correct, by somebody who's contributed to the industry, the maritime industry, a captain. And I think it just speaks to the quality of our staff that an award is actually named after one of our folks. So congratulations, Gary, and to the State Land folks as well for a well-deserved award.
Thank you.
Excellent. Our next order of business is the adoption of the consent calendar. Items C1 through C93. I call on Ms. Lucchese to indicate which items, if any, have been removed from the consent calendar.
Items C58, C65, C68, C94, C95, C96, C97, and C98 are all removed from the agenda and will be considered at a later time. Item 100 will be moved to the regular agenda for a presentation.
With that, I move approval of the consent calendar as revised.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. That would be Reyes and Garland voting. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to... Oh, we probably should have done that.
We did not have any speaker slips.
Excellent.
Submitted.
So we will skip that. Thank you to the audience. The next item of business is the regular calendar. Item... We're going to start with 100 since we pulled it, or do you
whatever,
want to put it at
the end? Whatever you wish to do.
All right. Let's... Let's stick to the script since I don't do well off script. And item 102 is to consider acceptance of the 2013 biennial report on the California Marine Invasive Species Program. May we have the staff presentation? Thank you.
So good morning, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. My name is Chris Schiani, and I'm a staff environmental scientist with the Marine Invasive Species Program within the Commission's Marine Facilities Division, and I'm going to be presenting the staff report for the 2013 biennial report on California's Marine Invasive Species Program. This report is required to be submitted by the Commission to the legislature every 2 years, as mandated by Public Resources Code Sections 71210 and 71212. This report is the sixth biennial report since the program was put into place in the year 2000, and this particular report outlines the program activities and vessel-reported traffic and management practices for the two-year period beginning July 1st, 2010 through June 30th, 2012. Among the topics that are covered in this report are an introduction to the issues of non-indigenous species and vessels serving as vectors of their introduction into California and coastal areas all around the world, an overview of the worldwide ballast water and biofouling regulatory regimes, both those that are currently in place as well as those that are in development, a chapter on California's Marine Invasive Species Program, including a description of the program's origins and the structure and function of the various components of the program, an analysis of the vessel-reported data on traffic and ballast water and biofouling management, and I've underlined that to indicate that I'm going to show you a couple of examples in the next couple of slides. We also include an overview of the external and commission-funded research on ballast water, biofouling, and marine invasive species in general that has been conducted or published over the past 2 years, and finally a section on conclusions and looking forward to what we will be doing over the next couple of years. So we wanted to share some of the data that we present in the report on California's on traffic to California ports. And over the past 2 years, we saw an average of about 4,800 vessels arriving per six-month period into California. And it's important to know what types of vessels are calling on California's ports and which ports they're actually calling to. So I'm not sure if you can see that from where you guys are sitting, but...
There.
We have here.
Perfect.
Our eyesight is down after the board.
This is showing us the ports of L.A., Long Beach, and Oakland on the x-axis, and along the y-axis on the left-hand side is the average number of qualifying voyages or arrivals per six-month period. The color scheme represents the different types of vessels that are arriving to California's ports, and these ports in particular So, for example, the green portion of each bar represents container vessels, which made up almost all of the arrivals to the Port of Oakland and a large fraction of the arrivals to the ports of LA and Long Beach. And overall, for the state, container vessels made up about 48% of all of the arrivals during this two-year period.
Please indulge me and tell me what the blue, the red, the orange, the green, I can't see from here.
The very top pink is unmanned barges. The light blue is tank vessels. The next one, I believe, is orange, is a passenger vessel. The next category is other. It's a catch-all for cranes and other types of barges that don't fit into these categories. The purple is general cargo. The green is container vessel. The red is bulk vessels. And the blue at the bottom are auto carriers.
Are bulk vessels the grain carrier?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. A big.
And then just one more question before we leave the number of vessels here. How does this compare to the previous report and previous two reports, maybe?
During the last report, we saw a decline in the arrivals, mainly because of the economic downturn. We did see a lot of the arrivals during the last. This report covers the end of 2010 through the beginning of 2012, so the previous 2 years we did see a big dip, and then we saw a slight incline for this period. So, yeah, we're looking, especially the last 6 months.
Can you address this, and maybe not here, but somewhere in there. I did a tour of the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles about a month ago, and one of the things I found really interesting, which I guess maybe you folks who work in this were well aware of, but I wasn't, which is how many of the ships come in full and we send them out empty. And I'm trying to, common sense would indicate to me that they're going to have, that they're doing something different with the ballast water because the weight of the ship is going to be so different. Can you just address that and how that particular circumstance of all these empty ships going back affects?
Sure. Will get to a bit of that a little bit later, but I do want to say that we don't really collect data on, especially the container ships, whether they're bringing or taking goods away. But we do know that we see a lot of vessels coming in from the Western Pacific, coming into the ports of LA and Long Beach first as a first stop, dropping off cargo there, maybe taking some containers, and then moving up to the Port of Oakland or other ports in Northern California, and maybe even going up further up the coast before going back to the Western Pacific. So,
okay. And then would they add ballast water there to make up for the lighter load?
Sometimes. A lot of the container vessels do not. They don't need to carry ballast because they're taking either full or empty containers, and they are configured so that they could move ballast water from tank to tank within a vessel, so they don't need to discharge.
Right.
And I'll get to that in the next slide.
Okay, thanks.
And then this one, it's even more difficult to see, but it's a similar slide, but it's just showing the same types of patterns for the rest of the ports in California. And we separated them because there's an order of magnitude difference between the ports of LA and Long Beach and these ports. But we do discuss that in the report.
Continue, please, without laughing.
Sure.
Mr.
I'll try. And then we wanted to share some information about ballast water exchange compliance rates, particularly compliance with the requirement to exchange ballast water in the open ocean if it's going to be discharged in California. So they have to exchange that water at least 50 nautical miles or at least 200 nautical miles from land, depending on where the vessel's coming from and where that water was originally sourced. So during this two-year time period, over 122 million metric tons of ballast water was reportedly carried into California in the ballast tanks of vessels. About 98% of that water that was carried in was reportedly managed in compliance with California law. So that's a great compliance rate, and the industry should be commended for that. The majority of the vessels do achieve compliance by reporting that they do not discharge ballast water in California. So 84% of the arrivals during this two-year period reported that they retained all ballast water on board. And some of it is the container vessels, and some of it may be tank vessels that are bringing product here and then take our ballast somewhere else.
Let me ask a question with regard to that breakdown. So if we've got 84% compliance, and I mean, obviously, I mean, as having been in different regulatory capacities in different part of my life, to use an example, it's a lot easier to regulate Chevron than it is Joe's Auto Body on the corner. Are we finding a particular pattern among the 16%? I'm trying to figure out, you have limited staff in your division, and I'm trying to determine whether randomly checking boats is our wisest path forward, or whether there is a certain subset that we should be targeting and giving some kind of housekeeping seal of good approval to companies, boats that have regular compliance records that are excellent, rather than wasting our time bothering those folks where we can really focus on the 16% that we know are our problem.
Well, so the 84% isn't necessarily the vessels that are complying. They're complying automatically because they don't discharge, and there's still a large chunk that is still complying beyond that. But we don't randomly go out and inspect and provide outreach. We do have a tiered approach where if it's a vessel's first time in California, they may not be aware of our requirements, so we do, that's our highest priority, is to go reach those vessels. If they have a previous violation or they're flagged for whatever reason, we go back on board to make sure that they understand what they should be doing and that they're doing it this time. So we do take a tiered approach, so it's not completely random.
Okay.
And just quick, it's a minimal difference, but is that 84% of the 98, or is that 84% of the whole?
That's 84% of the arrivals, not of the water. Yeah.
Okay.
So I was going to say that even with that, we do see about 28 million metric tons of water that is discharged in California during this two-year period. And then in the report, we analyze that 28 million metric tons to determine whether it was compliant or not with the requirements. And another small figure, I'll kind of skip over this and just say that the last 4 6-month periods is what we're wanted to show you. The black bars represent compliant ballast water, and the gray bars represent non-compliant ballast water. Okay. So overall for this two-year period, about 12.5% of the water that was actually discharged was not compliant with the exchange requirements.
Hmm. Let me ask one other question, Chris. It's come to mind as we see things from the Japanese tsunami washing up on West Coast shores with lots of living organisms on them. So we've got this sort of arbitrary 50-mile, you can discharge outside the 50-mile. Has there been any science done on what happens when we discharge? You know, we picked up stuff in Singapore or Shanghai or Yokohama. We discharge it 50 miles from California. It would strike me if things are making it all the way across the Pacific alive, that 50-mile radius might not exactly be what we need.
Well, when we went through the process of setting that 50-mile discharge limit or exchange limit, there was a lot of discussion with scientists, and there was a lot of models that played into that. So there was some science behind why the 50 nautical miles was chosen. Overall, the big theory is that if the organisms that are coastal in nature and more numerous because they're along the coast, if they're exchanged in the open ocean, even 50 nautical miles from shore, the water chemistry and the temperature and the lack of substrate will not allow them to.
But how does that jive with the fact that we're having docks float up from
well, that's
coastal regions of Japan that have still got numerous living organisms that are still alive when they get here?
Well, that's a big piece of floating substrate that a lot of those organisms need.
Okay, yeah. All right. So we think if we just discharge them into open ocean with nothing.
Yeah. It's not perfect, yeah. Okay. And that's why the world is moving towards performance standards.
Okay.
This figure is just showing of that non-compliant water, so that 12.5% of the discharge that was non-compliant. The black bars here represent water that was exchanged but in an incorrect location, so not at the 50 nautical mile limit or the 200. So the gray bar shows water that was not exchanged at all. So what we see is that even though 12.5% of the discharge was not compliant, the vast majority was actually exchanged. So the intent was there. The execution wasn't quite there. So those are areas where we would go out and try to target those vessels for better compliance. So that's where the outreach comes in. And then finally, just wanted to close with a quick bullet point of some of the issues that we're going to be dealing with over the next couple of years. Just mentioned on the last slide that we want to continue to provide outreach to the vessels to improve compliance where we can. 98% overall is great, but 12.5% of the discharged water is still non-compliant. So we want to make sure that we reach those vessels. We want to continue to support ballast water and biofouling research, both research that is funded by the commission that we're mandated by the legislature to fund, and also research that's external to what we're doing but will still push us forward. We continue to compile and analyze data related to vessel hull husbandry. As of the end of last year, we now have a good 5-year data set of hull husbandry trends for the vessels that operate in California, and staff intends to analyze those data and release those to the public in the next year and a half, in the form of a white paper and several peer-reviewed published journal articles. And we plan to use all of this information to continue the ongoing process of developing biofouling management regulations in collaboration with our stakeholders, and also work with our stakeholders to evaluate plans to implement California's performance standards for ballast water discharge. And that includes supporting an assessment of shore-based ballast water reception and treatment facilities, as well as the continuation of the development of transparent protocols for compliance assessment with ballast water performance standards. That's it. And I'd like to take any questions if you have any.
Mr. Harris?
Mr. Chair, I just want to say I found the report very informative. The one sentence that struck me when I read it was on page 60. Despite the overall decrease in the number of ships reporting discharging ballast water, the potential risk of NIS introduction per discharging ship is higher today than at any other time since the reporting began. That's pretty...
We're seeing much larger ships now with greater ballast capacities.
Right.
So that's just a function of the fact that each discharge event carries a lot more water.
More significant.
Yeah. Yeah, even though there are less discharge events,
yeah.
Each one is probably more risky.
I was just struck by that, and it's going to get worse just because of the size of the ships, mm-hmm. unless we do something. Thank you.
Thanks. It's been a really good report. Thanks.
That's an excellent report. Thank you. Any comments from the public on this report? Excellent. And we need to adopt the report officially?
Yes.
Do we have a motion?
Adoption of the report?
Second.
A motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oppose? It's passed unanimously with Commissioner Reyes and Commissioner Gordon voting in the affirmative.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great report. Next item is 103, to consider the adoption of the resolution acknowledging the 150th anniversary of the Port of San Francisco. May we have the staff presentation?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Calendar item 103 recommends that the commission adopt a resolution acknowledging the 150th anniversary of the Port of San Francisco and recognize the contributions of the port to the state and nation and to the San Francisco Bay Area. The Port of San Francisco was created in 1863 during the American Civil War. The lands underlying the port were granted to the city and county of San Francisco in 1968 as part of a statutory trust grant known as the Burton Act. Since that time, the commission staff has worked very collaboratively and diligently with the port on a variety of projects that help bring people to the waterfront and revitalize the area, such as the AT&T Ballpark, the Exploratorium, which will open on the waterfront in April, rehabilitation of the ferry building, and many other projects. To mark its anniversary, the port's having a series of celebrations, beginning with a big birthday bash on April 24th, a Maritime Day, and a reception at the historic ferry building. So in recognition of the port as a very important public trust asset and the work of the port, this recommendation is that the commission support a resolution acknowledging the 150th anniversary of the Port of San Francisco. Thank you.
Move approval of the resolution.
I have one question. You've managed to put together a resolution about San Francisco where there's no opposition?
Correct.
Wonderful work.
Thank you.
A first time for everything.
Yes.
I'll second.
We've got a motion and a second. Do we have any public comment before we vote? Excellent. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. This one I had to take. That's 2-0. So the motion carries. And the
that they opposed the sun rising in the east.
The resolution's adopted. That we move on now to item 104. It's the consideration of termination of the commercial lease to applicant Frank M. Cox, LLC. May we have the staff presentation?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Start the presentation. I have a PowerPoint presentation. If at any time you decide you want me to nix the presentation, I'm more than willing to do so. My name is Grace Cotto. I'm a member of the Land Management Division with this commission. Calendar item 104 is the consideration of the termination of a lease for the commercial use of filled and unfilled sovereign land located at 410 Airport Boulevard in the city of Burlingame. Tried to get new photos for you. So as you're aware, there's a long history of failed restaurant operations at this particular site. The commission was given a presentation at its August 14th, 2012 meeting with the staff recommendation to deny the lease based on an incomplete application. The commission then directed staff to continue working with Mr. Bothwell and the Frank M. Cox LLC and bring forth the recommendation at its next meeting. At the October 19th, 2012 commission meeting, staff recommendation on the lease application was again for denial, this time due to unresolved ownership issues of the vessel, a history of failed restaurant operations on the boat at this location, combined with concerns about the viability of Mr. Bothwell's and Frank M. Cox's particular business plan as presented by the applicants, and ongoing disagreement with the applicant on the lease terms. Mr. Bothwell and Mr. Higby represented Frank M. Cox and responded to the staff's recommendations for denial of the lease application and promised the commission the following: prepayment of 3 years of rent with a 5-year rent review, a contract from a reputable insured tugboat company to remove the vessel, the Frank M. Cox, from the lease premises, and a guarantee from Maxim Commercial Capital, the actual owner of the vessel, in lieu of a $500,000 bond to pay and be responsible for the removal of the vessel in case the lease was to be terminated. The commission approved the lease with these conditions and directed staff to then draft a lease subject to the conditions presented and promised to at the meeting. There are several communications that have occurred with Mr. Bothwell as well as Mr. Higby since the commission meeting, advising him of the lease conditions that have not been met. And we have subsequently provided 3 default notices, November 14th, December 18th, January 25th. As of this date, none of the lease conditions have been met by the applicant. The January 25th letter also addressed the unauthorized parking of Hertz rental cars on the lease premises. The staff has participated in several phone calls now with Maxim Commercial Capital, LLC, who is the owner of the vessel. They have advised staff that Frank M. Cox, LLC, is in default under the terms of their agreement, and that Maxim is interested in terminating their agreement with the Frank M. Cox, LLC. Therefore, at that point, once the agreement is terminated, Mr. Bothwell will no longer have the authority or the right to utilize the vessel at the site. Maxim has stated that they support staff's recommended default and termination action recommendation. This is a slide of the unauthorized parking at the site. I don't think I need to go into it any further. The lessee's in default under the first 3 conditions. This is just another example of lessee not doing what was authorized. The last slide is basically the staff's recommendation for the commission to find that the Frank M. Cox LLC is in default of the lease for failure to pay rent as provided in the lease, failure to maintain a contract from a reputable licensed tugboat company, failure to provide an executed guarantee from Maxim Commercial Capital, and just to put a last nail in the coffin, failure to provide evidence of insurance coverage. To also ask the commission to authorize staff to issue a notice of termination for the lease and authorize the staff and the Office of the Attorney General to take all necessary steps, including litigation, to eject Frank M. Cox, LLC, and recover trespass damages, seek removal of all restaurant-related improvements from the lease premises, restore the lease premises to the satisfaction of the commission, and to recover rents due under this lease term. If I'm available for any questions.
Any questions from the commissioners? I do have one comment, but I'll refrain.
Just a comment. All credit goes to the staff for the phenomenal job, particularly Ms. Cotto, trying to get this business up and running. I think we've bent over backwards, putting the limited resources of commission staff to make this project work. And they've given them every opportunity to comply, every opportunity to get this business going, and it's just clear that Mr. Bothwell doesn't have the resources to run a restaurant at this location. So, Ms. Cotto, you've done a fantastic job.
Thank you.
And I think you have brought this as close as it possibly can, and it's just not going to happen. That's the end of this sad saga.
I'd echo that. And our office was was involved in trying to make this work every way possible. And regrettably, I think we've come to a conclusion on this that we agree with the staff's recommendations. So, Do we have any public comment?
I would like to make a motion to support the termination of the lease and the notice as required by staff.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? We have Commissioner Reyes and Commissioner Gordon voting in the affirmative. Motion carries. Thank you again, Gerson.
Thank you very much.
All right. Now we are on to the items removed from the consent calendar. It's item 100 is an informational staff report on the renewable program activities involving school land consolidation efforts and participation in the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan. May we have the staff's presentation?
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and provide these bits of information to you. I'm Jennifer DeLeon. I'm the coordinator for the Commission's Renewable Energy Program. And I am here to provide a follow-up on the renewable energy program activities in the California desert. As you may remember, I was here in May of last year providing some information on the program's activities generally. This presentation is specifically to provide information on the status of staff's efforts related to the implementation of last year's legislation, AB 982, and also activities related to development of the DRECP. Just a quick note, the photograph on this cover sheet is of the Ivanpah Solar Facility. It's under construction currently on 3,500 acres in Ivanpah Dry Lake. It's on public land near the California-Nevada border by I-15. And this is one of the largest solar tower collector projects that's being done, and it has been permitted and is under construction. So the contents of this presentation, and it looks like my Mojave ground squirrel covered up some of the text there. So I'm going to cover three things, just a brief background on the legislative and policy history that guides our current efforts, a few of the milestones that we have reached to date, and then our upcoming activities for this and next year. The purpose of our activities in the desert are to pursue land exchanges with the BLM and also other available land transaction activities that would consolidate our school lands to allow us to more effectively administer our duties under the School Lands Act and provide revenue to the state teachers' retirement system. Secondly, participate in the development of the DRECP to ensure that our needs are protected and that it's consistent with and advances our goals and responsibilities on school lands. If we can accomplish these things, it would vastly improve our effective stewardship of our school lands and dramatically increase our revenue generating potential. As you all know, our ownership pattern currently is very scattered. Not a lot of large contiguous land holdings can make receiving and processing development applications somewhat difficult. So again, the first part of this is just to breeze through the brief background on some legislation and policy framework. In 2005, there was Schwarzenegger's executive order, among other target, it set a goal of reducing greenhouse gases to 80% of 1990 levels by 2050. So we had our 2020 goal and our 2050 goal. In 2011, the SB 2X in the extraordinary session codified the 33% renewables by 2020 goal into law. So that is what we're currently most motivated looking at now, what's driving the standards for generation set in the DRECP. Also in 2011, you all authorized the executive officer to enter into an MOU with the four REIT agencies, the Renewable Energy Action Team agencies, to participate in development of the DRECP. This MOU discussed exchange of data, information, cooperating, participating in meetings and ongoing development teams. It also expressed an intent if at the end of the day, we felt comfortable that we would sign on to implementation as a plan participant. And then again, late last year and taking effect in January 2012, or the year before and taking effect January 2012, AB 982 was passed, and this bill basically provided a mechanism and specific direction for the commission to enter into a series of land exchanges with the Bureau of Land Management in order to consolidate school lands specifically for the development of commercial scale renewable energy projects. So that's basically the lay of the land, what we're working under. So what is AB 982? Why is it so important? How does it relate to the DRECP? And they really do work in a coordinated way together to help us achieve our goals. It created a new chapter in the School Land Bank Act, or in Division 7.7, that directs us to pursue these land exchanges to consolidate school lands. The second thing that it does that is equally as important and really relates even more to the DRECP is that it requires us to consult with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to ensure that any development application, that any exchanges that we undertake to create contiguous parcels for renewable energy development are not located in areas that the wildlife agencies believe are important for conservation of species or natural communities. So again, it relates to the DRECP because of this consultation provision. And in addition to screening these land exchanges, helping guide our prioritization of the land exchanges to see where we do not want to have projects, it's also to screen it to say, where do we have lands or where can we create blocks of land that would be suitable for mitigation or conservation? This is important because it helps the commission with its policy resolution on the environmentally responsible development of renewable energy projects that was approved in 2008. Another really important part of this is the data sharing. There has been massive amounts of data collected, modeling, expert reports, ground truthing, and that has really helped drive the proposal that we have been working on with the BLM. And then lastly, both AB 982 and the DRECP share common goals of both developing renewable energy more streamlined, cost-effective, and efficiently, but also hand-in-hand with environmental protection. And the photograph here is just an example of a solar PV project, as opposed to the earlier one, which was a solar collector type of project. And you can see that there are a few differences. And so one of the things the DRECP does is it tries to look at location, not only just locations for development generally, but also what different types of projects are suitable for which areas. There's some that wind is okay, wind is not okay. So that's one of the things. So it's really to help us pre-screen almost areas that would benefit applicants and the amount of money and time they have to expend to get a project off the ground. So we have a few opportunities. Most importantly, momentum. AB 982 has really been a good tool for us to use when we go to meetings and participate in groups developing the DRECP, because we can then go to them and say, this is a goal, it has been stated, the BLM has signed the memorandum of agreement, we need to do this, and the DRECP needs to not stand in the way of effectuating that legislation. It can help us resolve our inholdings, which has been a big problem, and then there's the potential streamlining advantage of having these areas that they're a known quantity. The applicants can come in, they know significant work has been done related to the types of communities, vegetation, animals there, and they know that their project is much more of a sure thing. Challenges, on the other hand, that we're still working on is the concept of long-term or perpetual conservation is one of the important pieces of the Natural Community Conservation Planning Act, which is the stateside approval process. And for our lands in particular, if we were to use it for conservation, we have a lease terms that are not in perpetuity. There was also the question of, is using it for conservation maximizing the revenue potential? And then we would need to work on resolving our minerals constraints, whereby even if we were to transfer title to the surface, we would not be able to preclude somebody from developing minerals, which may be incompatible with conservation. And lastly, just as a side note, there are some federal process constraints that can slow and complicate our exchange process, but we are working to resolve those with the BLM Realty staff. So really quickly, we have had three milestones from last year. We did sign the MOA with the BLM. We set out a process for prioritizing the land exchanges. In December, the DRECP working group released an interim document. It's a pre-CEQA. They wanted to show transparency, progress, and they wanted to get some feedback from the public. And this had maps that showed some their preliminary screening for development areas. In January, we presented our land exchange proposal to BLM. This was a requirement in the AB 982 legislation that we do this, and we met our deadline to provide that to them. This basically set forth, we will give you all of our lands, but for a few, or offer them. And what we want back is all of your BLM land in the development areas. And as you heard from our GIS folks last time, they've gotten quite advanced with their GIS capability. They've made a lot of progress on mapping some of the lands. So I wanted to throw in this little map. This is what they did for us. They were able to run a query so that the BLM land popped out in pink. That was what we wanted. So all of those pink lands are BLM-owned lands that are within the areas identified in the interim document as being developable areas. So even though as of now these may change and evolve as the DRECP gets developed further, the concept is there, and we have the capability of very quickly and easily identifying BLM lands to say, this is what we would like from you, because our goal is to develop renewable energy. And lastly, coming up in this next year or year and a half, we will continue to participate in developing the DRECP. The REIT agencies met last week in order to respond to comments received on the December interim document, and they are now revising some of the development areas, revising how they're zoning conservation areas. So we'll make sure that we continue to protect the Commission's interests as we develop the DRECP. We'll continue to coordinate with BLM staff. We hope to develop maps as well as language to go actually into the DRECP itself to memorialize the commitments made to exchange lands, which will go a long way to helping us feel more comfortable that those exchanges would actually happen and provide momentum to sign on as a plan participant. And we hope to enter into one or more exchange agreements during the next year as well. And then lastly, we are going to be working on options for our role in implementation. So I bring this up just to kind of give the early tap on the shoulder for whether we might get to a point where staff could put together a recommendation for the Commission's consideration of participating in implementation of the DRECP as a permittee under the Natural Community Conservation Planning Act and the Federal Endangered Species Act. Doing so would entail making commitments both to implement the DRECP conditions as they are stated, and then also take on the limitations that are so stated. So doing this would be something that would be to our advantage in terms of streamlining projects. It would be an incentive for applicants to come to our property because they would not have to go to all of the federal and state endangered species permitting processes, because we would have it for them already and could delegate that authorization. Conversely, we would be committing ourselves to ensuring that the conservation goals and the conditions of approval were met. So it would affect how we exercise our discretion in our approvals. So I just wanted to give that quick heads up that that would be coming up.
Actually, if you can hold right there for a second, and I'd like to ask our counsel, both in-house and from the Attorney General's office, about that last point. And if we would be hamstring or hurting ourselves by participating and agreeing to the larger conditions and limitations and what that would mean for us long term.
I have not specifically looked at this program, and I don't know that anybody from our office has, but school lands are not like your usual sovereign lands, which are subject to the public trust and have restrictions on long-term use and alienation. And so these school lands, if the commission wanted to, it would have the discretion to make itself subject to terms, conditions that it wouldn't have the discretion to do on its sovereign lands.
Exactly the answer I was looking for, but if you'd like to expand on that, please do.
I just wanted to add that, Jennifer, correct me if I'm wrong, but if the commission chose to exercise its discretion in that matter and become a permittee, it could also withdraw from that.
Correct.
At any point, it decided that it was not in the best interest of the school land bank trust or the school land bank fund, the commission, and the state's best interest.
Yes, that's correct. The permits that are issued under the federal and state statutes are intended to be fully severable. The California Energy Commission is currently the other entity that is looking at being a permittee under the DRECP, and there are continuing discussions with the counties that are encompassed by the planning area, and it looks as though the city of Lancaster is very interested in the county, I think the county of San Bernardino, but I'm not 100% sure on that, but there are ongoing discussions and outreach with the counties, and the permits are severable. Those terms are outlined in the implementation agreement, which would also be signed, and so there would be opportunity for legal counsel to make recommendations on the implementation agreement.
And we're very sensitive to both the pros and the cons of becoming a permittee, and so when it is time to bring this to the commission for your consideration, we will very clearly articulate all the pros and all the cons so that the commission can make an informed decision. But we're very sensitive to all those issues.
Yeah. Thank you.
It would basically be a trade-off where we would have the opportunity to get some sort of additional development revenue on our school lands that we are not currently getting because of their configuration and the difficulties in getting development permits. But it would also then help us achieve our policy goals as outlined in the 2008 resolution of doing it in a balanced and environmentally responsible fashion, because we would be committing to conservation in trade-off for our ability to develop those lands.
Thank you. Any other comments from the commissioners? Commissioner Reyes?
She was in a roll, so I didn't want to interrupt, but I'm going to take you back a little bit here. When we talk about developable lands, we're talking about renewable energy development, not just any development, right?
That's correct. The DRECP, the covered activities are specifically for renewable energy development, which includes the several types of solar, wind, and geothermal.
Okay. I just want to make sure people understood that we're talking about a very specific renewable, not just open. When we work with the federal government, do we work with any other state agencies in this process? Are we involved with the Energy Commission or other? We go in as a team with other state agencies?
Yes. The four REIT agencies are the Fish and Wildlife Service and the BLM on the federal side, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Energy Commission on the state side. In addition to those four, we call them the Big Four. We are participating Department of Defense, National Parks, State Parks, a huge number of collaborators, right, as well as independent science advisors.
Okay. I was able to download the application, looked in my iPad, the mapping, and so kudos to whoever did that work. That was great, and very appreciative to the person that helped me get through there, because even though I have one, I'm technically inefficient or not proficient.
That, if I may, just put a shout-out to them. That was Michael Bell, Jim Kepke, yes, and the rest of our boundary staff in our land management division.
Incredible.
They are amazing.
That was fantastic. And then one last observation, Mr. Chair, and I should have brought this up to Jennifer separately, but I'll bring it up publicly. When you do a PowerPoint presentation, if you could share that with us so we can follow ahead of time, mm-hmm. either electronically or hard copy. When we were doing the Balas invasive species one, I recognize a lot of the charts from the report, but you know, I did not want to start looking for page 56 and 57 where I thought the reports were when you were showing them to us. So we can have that here. That way we don't have to. Some of us are kind of old, and our vision is gone. Notwithstanding the age.
Of course, we will definitely provide the PowerPoint ahead of time, and then hopefully our next commission meeting will be in a room that we can have bigger screens.
Yes, it's adding cute animal photos this morning at 10 after 9 per Jennifer's recommendation. She said it gets them every time.
I do have one question. Among the agencies you guys have been negotiating with, are you in ongoing conversations with the Marine Corps? It's my understanding that they have some significant land exchanges they would like to engage in, that they have some... The Marine Corps has become a major wildlife protection agency, which for whatever reason they don't view as their primary function. And they seem to have a lot of land, they said, in the Chocolate Mountains that they would like to exchange for lands that they can do their stuff on.
Yes, the Department of Defense has been very actively engaged in all of the executive team meetings, all of the technical team meetings. Major Garza has been at every meeting, very, very dedicated. The lands that are encompassed by the 29 Palms training base expansion were not included in, for that very reason that you state, were not included in the list of lands that we sent in our exchange proposal to the Bureau of Land Management. And those transactions, I believe, are ongoing, but I would have to ask Jim Porter.
Thanks. Thank you very much for the presentation. Any public comments? Excellent.
That staff report was informational, so there's no vote needed.
Excellent. All right, that concludes our consent and pulled items and regular session. Ms. Lucchese, what's the next order of business?
We can move on to public comment.
Excellent. We have several cards here for public comment. I believe they are all relating to a single issue. Yes, Pete's Harbor. One of our favorites. I would like to acknowledge that during this meeting we did receive communication from the proponents of Pete Harbor.
Actually, from the legal representative of Ms. Uccelli.
There you go. That's the word that I was looking for. Seem a little confused about what public comment at a open meeting means, but we are in receipt of that, and the staff has noted it and taken those comments to their proper consideration.
Mr. Hannig's email will be made part of the record for the public comment portion of this meeting.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Moving on now, we've got, I'm going to call a couple at a time. Remember, there is a time limit. The public comment microphone is over here on the left. It's the stand-up mic. Keep an eye on our lights in front of you, or do we want to just use the center mic?
It would be fine.
We'll use the center mic because the lights are there. I ask that you would be respectful of those behind you and of the timekeepers. And we'll start with Rick Drain, and then Eric Pease, Allison Madden, Joseph Rosas, and then finally with Sean Cartwright. Thank you. Mr. Drain.
Good morning. I'm Rick Drain. I'm here to talk to you about Pete's Harbor. We briefed you a couple of weeks ago as well that Pete's Harbor is being developed. You own land that has a marina on it that was leased to Pete Uccelli, DBA Pete's Harbor, some decades ago. And we want to be sure that in this development, a marina continues to exist for the public. We want it to be a public marina consistent with the public trust. And we want to be sure that it's an economically viable marina from the start. Otherwise, it's just going to die. So if we want to keep a marina there, and we certainly do, it has to be big enough. And we've talked to some organizations that manage marinas. It's also important that it be kept in good condition, that the turnover be in good condition. So we do hope that you'll, since there will be discussions between your organization and the developers, we hope that you'll keep those things in mind. Please keep a public access marina. Please make sure that it's big enough and in good enough condition when it's turned over to be economically viable so that it will continue to be a marina for more decades. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for your comments. Next up is Eric Pease. Ms. Madden, good to see you again.
Thank you. So I wanted to say we are here speaking in public comments just so we can continue to make the public record. We've been working, everyone's been working very closely with staff, and they've just done a tremendous job really from the start, collecting all the information and kind of progressively informing the City Council of Redwood City and the planning staff about the nature of public trust lands. And the initial proposal was to make this a fully private marina appurtenant to the Uplands condo development. And it looks like it's developed to the point where that's probably not going to happen, and that's a huge victory. And in the meantime, the commission was successful in getting a serious delinquency cured and showing that it is currently in an insurable status, which is another huge win. And so that's two victories already. And there was a this same developer actually took over a marina down the road and then said it's uninsurable and ripped it out. And so it's unclear whether the approval of a private marina and this status of whether it needs repairs and upgrades was going to lead to the same thing. And so right now we have the staff looking at the repairs and upgrades and the staff saying, please show us your plan. So that's the third victory. So right now, just the involvement of the State Lands Commission has resulted in three victories, I think. And I think that the State Lands Commission was first approached 2 days before the tenants were, which was months after the PD, the Plan Development Permit application, was filed. So really, a lot of this should have happened last July, last October, you know, and not now, because my understanding from a Public Records Act request is that a plan for repairs and upgrades has still not been delivered. And if you had that plan all along, you would think you would have your engineer, you would have your time, your milestones, and you would have already disclosed that. So we think it's been a huge victory all around to at least protect this asset until there's a full and final determination. We'd like to say going forward to please continue to include the public. I think right now, you know, there's a current owner who's closing the marina, and there's a potential new buyer who now is representing to the public that they are willing and able to make it a commercial marina for recreational use. But I'd like to say that their term sheet offered to us included actually destroying the consent lease. There's a smaller lease. It's called the small lease, the Leslie Salt lease, the consent lease. And there's already existing use of a public kayak and small flat-bottom boat launch there. People have been doing that for decades. And it would be reducing the public access to tear that out. So part of their proposal for the public trust and the commercial marina is actually destroying the lease on which the State Lands Commission has leverage. And it's, you didn't need to give it to them in the first place, is my understanding. And it's fully in the State Lands Commission's discretion whether to transfer that and to transfer it with conditions. And I see that my time is up. The condition I'd like to see is the 10% liveaboards. There's 263 slips in the EIR. And if you consented to transfer that and requiring 26 liveaboards to stay there, I think it's consistent with the public trust, which includes commerce, navigation, recreation, and fisheries, and living. Liveaboards living on water is not the same kind of exclusive private residence that is usually, you know, not favored on a large public open trust tract. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Next would be Mr. Pease.
Hello and thank you. I'm currently living at Pete's Harbor, and I've been watching the eviction of all my neighbors during this time. In advance of, I think, your final decision, so I don't know what their rush to empty the marina is. It seems inconsistent with what I've heard and what I've learned through my attorney, Allison Madden. I do think it's important to keep a marina there for the public trust. And based on the plans that I've seen, I don't know that that's going to happen, and it makes me concerned. I'm also concerned in the manner of which the marina is currently evicting folks and getting rid of them. They are literally terrorizing them. They've closed walkways. They've shut off lights. They've removed trash receptacles for people to, you know, responsibly get rid of their refuse. All under the guise that, you know, they can do what they want on their land. It's not theirs. It's yours. And I don't believe that they're managing it consistent with the rules that you've set forth. And that's really all I have to say. I just would like to see it remain a marina that has people live there, people enjoy it. I think the public wants it there. Every day new boats are being terrorized to leave. Boats that don't run are being towed away. They're making neighbors of mine sign things that say that they'll have judgments even though they're leaving. It seems inconsistent with anything that I've ever seen or heard of in anything like this. It's just ridiculous, and that's basically what I have to say. I'd like to see it remain in a marina that allows people to live there, allows it for public use, and not decimate a waterfront community all up and down the state. We're losing waterfront communities everywhere, and I think it's a shame. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next up is Joseph Rosas.
Good morning, Commission, fellow Californians. Actually, my comment's going to be fairly quick today. I just came to thank the Commission for any and all communications that there was between the Commission and the city of Redwood City. As somebody who doesn't live in Redwood City, I'm often seen when I go to their meetings that I have less say in the matter, even though this is an issue that concerns everybody on the peninsula and everybody in the state, as this is public land. So I would once again like to thank you for amplifying our voice for those that aren't often heard at the local level. And I would also like to thank anybody else who's been involved in this issue on one side or the other, because it is very important that, as this is public land, everybody is heard on issues regarding things that are technically ours. I would like to thank everybody for any political and personal pressure that they have placed on the city of or on the council of Redwood City, as they have not been very receptive to public comments from anybody outside of their personal circle. Once again, thank you.
Thank you, sir. We have two speakers left. Sean Cartwright would be next, and then followed by James Lee. Welcome back, Ms. Cartwright.
Howdy. Nice to see you again. I wanted to thank you all for everything that you've done so far. We really appreciate it. It's nice to have people doing the right thing and fighting for public trust and public lands. The developer has offered a select few well-publicized what could be deemed move-out incentives, but no actual compromise on the size of the development, which would allow the harbor and the development to peacefully coexist. I think it was something that you had suggested, which would make a lot of sense, but instead has just thrown money out there rather than saying, if I made the development smaller, you guys could stay, I could stay, and there could be some harmony, but instead thinking that money cures all. There's also the issue of, which I think is an interest, maybe not your purview, but your interest of BMR housing. There's 10,000 housing projects right now, or 10,000 units in San Mateo County alone that are proposed housing units, and not one of them is BMR housing, not one in 10,000. And Peace Harbor has always been part of the general plan, partly because it is affordable housing. And that's definitely something to consider. Shade. We're talking 5-6-story buildings and definitely going to be shade that's going to be on the trail and definitely going to be affecting things. If I'm going to take part in something and I'm going to enjoy the land, I want to enjoy the sun, the air, the water, not be someplace that's cold and chilly and definitely in the shade. They've torn out the cleats. They've put wires, really thick gauge wires, across your land, my land. This isn't private land. This is public land. Which endanger the public, which endanger the boats. And so when you take out cleats, nobody can tie their boats off. If a boat in trouble came in, they can't tie off. Putting wires across it, there's no caution tape. There's nothing that says it's there. So it could damage a boat. It could rip a cleat off. It could hurt somebody who's there. It could hurt a boat. This is what's happened on our land, not private land. There's sawhorses there saying people can't go down there. There's the harassment of the boaters. Lastly, this is, was, and should remain an economically viable public marina. It's public trust for public use. It's public land. And I'm hoping you guys continue to do the right thing and keep it that way. And I'm also hoping that in the meantime, something can be done because you only got a couple boaters there. And they're really holding down the fort for us. And the abuse that's being hurled upon them and the torture that they go through on a daily basis, I don't know if they can hold out much longer. And they really need all the help that they can get. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do have one question for staff. If, as was just asserted, there's a dangerous situation or dangerous conditions being, you know, presented to people who were there on our land, have we had anybody go out and inspect and see if they're in lease compliance? And particularly troubling is you know, wires being or chain being put up and creating a dangerous situation on state lands. And if we could just have somebody check that out and make sure that they're in compliance and that they're not creating a dangerous situation.
Yes, we will definitely send somebody out there next week.
Thank you. Our final comment would be James Lee. James, thank you.
Really good to see you guys again. Well, first, I just want to thank you for that. That would be extremely helpful to have you guys come out to the harbor and see firsthand what's going on. I first wanted to start off by, like Joseph, thanking you for, well, in particular for the letter you sent to the city of Redwood City late last month. That was really helpful. I wanted to also let you guys know that Save Beats Harbor did formally incorporate as a nonprofit public benefit entity. We're really proud of the fact that we've done this. We formalized a process that we started last fall or winter, and we're excited because we're also drawing in members of the public, and we really want to make the case that this is a public issue. It's not, I think the perception has been in a lot of places that this is a tenant versus landlord issue, and it's really not, and you guys know that, but I am really proud of the fact that we're making that case to the public. Our president, Leslie Webster, wasn't able to be here today. She wants to apologize for not being here. She spoke to you guys at the special meeting last month, and I think on the December 5th meeting as well. And she looks forward to coming back up again. I do want to mention that I am concerned about one of the impacts, which could be, which I think falls under CEQA, is the community displacement issue. Peace Harbor isn't the only harbor or marina in Redwood City that's under threat. We have Docktown Marina that's under threat. Before Peace Harbor, there was Peninsula Marina, which right now sits empty and had about 450 slips before folks were evicted back in 2006. There's a lot of displacement of the boating community on the peninsula. A lot of these people have nowhere to go. As Sean mentioned earlier, this does tie in with the fact that people are being pushed off of land onto water because of the lack of affordable housing. So boating communities are ever more crucial to the health of the Bay Area and the peninsula. And so we just really feel that the impact of all these people being displaced and being dispersed across the Bay Area is really huge and something to consider and to kind of piggyback on what Allison said, we want to make sure that once hopefully we can get a commercial, environmentally friendly marina open again at Pete's Harbor, that it will be something where we can have liveaboards, where it is affordable to liveaboards like Pete's Harbor was. So again, I want to thank you for all your work. Please stay in touch with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I believe that concludes our public comment section, unless something else has come in. It doesn't appear that it has. Do the commission...
If I may just provide a couple of comments on Pete's Harbor to give the commission a sense of where staff is and our interactions with... we've had numerous communications with Ms. Madden and other folks at Save Pete's Harbor and other interested individuals. We've also recently received a lease application for the smaller lease, the consent lease from the developer. We are just beginning to process that. And finally, we're continuing to work with Ms. Uccelli and her representatives on obtaining a work plan, which, if you may recall, that was the reason why they needed to close down the marina, because they had to do certain repairs. So we are continuing to work on all fronts to move this thing forward.
I have two comments on this. Actually, Peter, did you have something? No. Number one, I was contacted about a month ago by a fairly well-respected local politician in the Bay Area who had been contacted by the Uccelli developer. The response, he wasn't in any way putting pressure. He just wanted to see what was going on and where we were going with it. And when I told him that we were very open to, at least the commission through its comments and votes, was very open to a compromise where the marina would remain open and yet the development would go on, he relayed that message back to the developer, and nothing has come of that whatsoever, which the silence leads me to believe that the developer is not interested in any compromise whatsoever. The second piece of this that is becoming more apparent to me as time goes on, as the controller's office is sponsoring a bill having to do with local government and impacts of climate change in low-lying areas around the state, strikes me that a development down close to the water is exactly what we don't want going forward as we look at projections for where sea rise is going to go over time. And keeping affordable housing close to the water strikes me as a long-term positive land use for the state, as those will be able to remain, while lots of other types of development, we're going to be in a situation where we're either going to back off of them in the future, or we're going to have to seriously go for Dutch-style levies to protect them, which has a cost that I don't believe the people of California wish to spend. So to the extent that local governments are permitting housing projects in what is going to be a sea level rise conflicted zone, it strikes me as extremely stupid development, and leaks from the perspective of the controller's office, where we are sponsoring legislation to force local governments to at least consider these long-term impacts. It strikes me that we need to work very hard, and I know the staff is doing so, but I just wanted to reiterate from our office the perspective that developing down in that tidal zone is not wise use for state lands in the future, and we need to start considering those impacts going forward. Thank you.
Any additional comments or concerns from the commissioners? Excellent. That, I believe, concludes our open meeting. We'll now adjourn into closed session. Will the public please clear the room? We're back in session. We've concluded our closed session. Any other business for us to take up at this time?
No.
Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second. We are adjourned.